Welcome to Biology with Alexandra. Today we'll be looking at animal physiology, more specifically antibody production and how vaccinations work. I'll also be going into the standard level content on both innate and adaptive immunity, as well as going into the blood clotting and how that works. First of all, we need to understand that immunity is our ability to resist disease. And first of all, I'd like to start by talking about our blood. And so our red blood cells, they have antigens around the outside. And these antigens are markers which usually induce an immune response in the body and a production of antibodies. But in the context of the red blood cells, they kind of mark what group they are. So group A has the group A antigens, group B has B antigens, and AB has both the A and B antigens. And what's special about group O is it doesn't have any antigens. And that's what makes the O blood group able to transfuse their blood into anybody else. But how come we can't just give any other cells to someone else? Wouldn't their body reject them? Well, the reason why we can do this with red blood cells is that they don't have a nucleus, so there's no genetic information that would be rejected by the body. What would be rejected is if you mix the wrong groups. And the reason as to this is because we have antibodies that fit with the antigens. So the antibodies are blood proteins which are produced in response to and counteracting a specific antigen. So let's say I'm group A and my sister is group B and I get hurt. I can't receive blood from her because I have anti-B antibodies in my cells which would latch onto the B antigens on her red blood cells, which would cause them to clump, maybe a blood clot, and that can be very dangerous. So the group A has A antigens and so on, and so that means that group A can give blood to group AB because AB has A and B antigens. Group B can also give to AB, and O can give to AB. A can only receive from A and O because if it were to receive from B, as I said before, it just wouldn't work. Now, the problem with group O is it's good to be a donor, but if you try and receive blood, you also need to be from group O because it has anti-A and anti-B antibodies. So if you get a picture up of this or in your mind, just think about the antigens that are on the outside of the red blood cell, and anything which isn't on the red blood cell itself, there will be antibodies against that, so it can be dangerous to get that blood from somebody else. If, in fact, two blood groups are mixed, then what occurs is agglutination, which is the clumping of cells together. And that would happen, let's say, if I actually received that blood from my sister and I had group A, she had group B, and this can be very dangerous as it leads to blood clots, as well as hemolysis, which is when the blood cell membrane breaks. And we know that lyse means split, so it's literally the splitting of the cell, and that can make it leak fluid, including hemoglobin, which is the protein that carries oxygen. So that's very important that it doesn't happen. We also have something called the rhesus factor, which is the Rh plus or minus, you can also see. And so that's basically another antigen found on the surface of our red blood cells, And if you're positive, so if you have it, it's a plus, and it's a minus when you lack it. So that further complicates whether the blood can be transfused into someone. Blood clotting also occurs when someone cuts themselves, and this is the body's way to seal the wound and make sure no further blood is lost. So we all know that feeling. We've grazed our knee, the blood begins to thicken, forming a gel. Next, we have a soft scab, which begins to harden, and this scab is meant to keep out pathogens and, of course, prevent us from losing all of our blood. And red blood cells, also called erythrocytes, so you might be asked that in a multiple choice question. And we also need to know that the red blood cells are floating in a kind of yellowish liquid, which is called the plasma. So when there's not much colour, that's either the white blood cells or the plasma, which holds our blood cells. So first of all, we've fallen down and the tissue is damaged, and this releases blood clotting factors. The blood clotting factors activate prothrombin, and that turns into thrombin. Then the thrombin activates more clotting factors to create more thrombin. And this is a kind of positive feedback loop in which thrombin activates platelets, which are disc-shaped cells, which are actually fragments of bone marrow cells. And they essentially form a plug or clot to stop bleeding and also damage the repair. And thrombin is a type of protease enzyme which converts fibrinogen from a soluble form into a fibrous protein called fibrin. So there's a lot of vocabulary in this little section, but what we generally need to remember is first, the clotting factors activate our prothrombin into thrombin, then the thrombin activates more clotting factors to create more thrombin, the thrombin converts fibrinogen, which is basically our enzyme which is floating in this plasma, and it remains a liquid for most of the time so that clots aren't just created randomly, which could be harmful inside the blood vessels, but it turns into the protein called fibrin, which basically is a net, and it captures the blood cells, which really forms this clot. And this fibrin is white, and that's what kind of plugs the hole. So now we know the difference between our antigens and antibodies, I'd like to look at immunity in a more general sense, and we're going to look at topic 6 again quickly and see the difference between our innate and adaptive immunity. So our innate immune system is the first line of defense. We don't want any of these bad bacterial viruses to come inside our body. So the largest organ, our skin, does that very well. The mucus lining of our respiratory tract, such as in the nose, also helps. And with other openings, there are also such in the ears. We also have earwax, so those are parts of innate immunity. We also have barriers on a chemical level, so we have macrophages, and these are cells that recognize harmful bacteria or viruses, including infected cells, and this is done through chemotaxis. So basically, they can recognize microbial products or components, and that allows them to engulf these cells. And they're called big eaters, from the actual original word macrophage. And they're a type of phagocyte because they carry out phagocytosis. And if you remember from unit 1, that's a type of endocytosis, which means that they basically eat different substances. And how this works is that the macrophage attaches to the microbe and it uses receptors to help it. And then the fluidity of our cell membrane made of our, you know, our phospholipid bilayer, that allows it to open and engulf this substance. So let's say it's a bad bacteria. Then the bacteria is in a vesicle called a phagosome, and it fuses with a lysosome, which releases digestive enzymes, or it lowers the pH, which basically breaks down our microbe. And then at the end, the phagosome ejects the digested microorganism and the disease-causing bacteria is out. Now, for adaptive or specific immunity, the macrophage actually, after engulfing and this microorganism, it displays kind of pieces of it called cytokines, and these kind of act as signals. And when a helper T lymphocyte cell comes by, and we remember that lymphocytes are white blood cells, so when a helper T cell is activated by these cytokines, it activates the B lymphocyte cells to multiply. So the helper T cell activates the B cell, and the B cells can multiply and differentiate into two types. Firstly, we have plasma cells, and plasma cells make antibodies to fight that specific pathogen that the macrophage had previously engulfed. So that's what our cytokines help to kind of signal, oh, you need to kill this type. And then the B cells make an antibody to be able to fit that specific pathogen. Then we also have memory B cells, and they store information on the antibodies so that they can be immediately activated in the future, making the response faster if it happens a second time. So if we encounter the same pathogen later on in our lives, we can get rid of it quickly. And that's why a lot of people don't get the same disease twice. With flu, it's different because those viruses often change very quickly and mutate, so they're not the exact same. But with other diseases, it's quite easy for the memory B cells to then activate and differentiate into our plasma cells and create antibodies again. And so these antibodies, they are important because they act as markers for phagocytes, for different specific cells to engulf. And the antibodies are also helpful in that they can block the pathogen's active sites, or block a bacteria, a virus from attaching to a host cell. And they can also clump together, which makes it easier for the microbes to be spotted by these phagocytes and removed. Though you may not believe it, there are times when our body makes mistakes, and this can occur when we get allergic reactions. So it happens when the body reacts to a non-harmful antigen, such as pollen. After our first encounter, B cells are produced as a response, and in subsequent encounters with this antigen, they can trigger mast cells, and these are just other immune cells, and they release histamine. So histamine is what causes the swelling, redness, vasodilation, so the enlargement of our blood vessels, which causes low blood pressure, and fever. And these are all symptoms of allergic reactions. Anaphylaxis, or anaphylactic shock, is when this is very severe. That's why people use antihistamine as an anti-inflammatory drug to ease their symptoms. Another use is adrenaline, which is usually injected, and that increases our blood pressure because when our blood pressure is very low, that's how we get into this anaphylactic shock. Luckily, scientists are very good at looking at what's going on in our bodies and using these processes to our advantage. An example of this is when harvesting antibodies for a specific pathogen. So let's say someone is suffering from a virus, and it's difficult for them to recover. So antibiotics in this case would not work, as they can only target bacteria. And so if we can create the antibodies and inject those into the patient, then they would be able to recover faster. So a way to do this is to take a specimen, and usually these are mice, and you inject the chosen antigen, so in our case, the destructive virus. So as we spoke of earlier, the B cells in the mouse will activate and they'll produce the plasma cells, which produce antibodies. So what you do is you then extract the plasma cells and you put them into a Petri dish. And to get these cells to divide, you can fuse them with myeloma. And these are tumor cells. And that means that they will keep dividing continuously, and our plasma cells will be continuously producing these antibodies that we need. You culture the hybridoma in several Petri dishes, and you have to check each of them to make sure they've produced the correct antibodies, and then these antibodies can be extracted and purified for medical use. These harvested antibodies aren't only used for treating disease, but can be used for other purposes, such as in pregnancy tests. And they're actually called monoclonal antibodies. And this is because they're monospecific, meaning that they target a certain antigen. And they do this by recognizing a certain section of it called an epitope. And basically, it's just a string of amino acids that they recognize on that antigen. So with pregnancy tests, the way we can use antibodies is that when the embryo implants into the uterus lining, there is a hormone that is released and it's called HCG. And in our pregnancy test stick, they basically have the antibodies of the HCG. So it's first dipped into the woman's urine, and if the HCG is present, then the antibodies for HCG, which were previously harvested, let's say from a mouse, they'll bind. So we have the HCG hormone and antibodies, and they bind together. And the reason that we can see this come up on the stick is that the antibodies are coupled with a blue dye, for example, so that blue comes up as a line and that indicates that the woman is pregnant. And there's always a second control line, which has other antibodies for proteins that are in all urine to make sure the test worked. So the second line, the control line, should always go blue. And if that doesn't happen, then it means the urine didn't travel up the stick properly and the test didn't work. But yeah, this is a use of the antibodies, which isn't necessarily for life-threatening situations. And there are also other uses for it, but this is just one example that you should know. Another way in which we use our body's ability to create antibodies is when trying to prevent diseases, and this is when we created vaccinations. So what happens is we use a weakened pathogen and expose the body to the antigen so that antibodies and memory B cells can be produced. And this is very helpful in that the patient is not immediately exposed to the full-on disease that could kill them, but it's a weakened version so that the body gets a chance to react first with these macrophages and then create memory B cells so that if the disease is encountered in reality, it can be quickly fought. And this can help prevent sickness, but also eradicate disease. And the first disease that vaccinations manage to eradicate is smallpox. So this is very useful, and vaccinations are often then used for viruses, as I said before, because they antibiotics don't work for viruses. Thank you for listening to IB Biology Explained by me, Alexandra Higson, and I hope that you learned something. Please stay tuned for the next episodes coming soon.